The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between Adam Falk, president of the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving, on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center is one of the most highly regarded institutions of its kind in the world, as is the Sloan School of Management, that being the business school at MIT. In both cases, the Sloan refers to Alfred P. Sloan, who also founded a foundation that bears his name back in 1934. And here to tell us about it and all the work that they do is Adam Falk, the president of the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Good evening, Adam, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Adam, tell us about the mission of the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
So at the Sloan Foundation, we support science and economics. And that means supporting research in science and economics done by scholars, but also supporting people. The young people who do that work, graduate students and young faculty, we support the diversity of those fields, and we support tools that people use to do that work, as well as the public understanding of that work.
You know, before we get into that work at the foundation, who was Alfred P. Sloan, and what is he remembered for?
So Alfred P. Sloan built the modern General Motors. So if you think of General Motors as that company that has divisions, Pontiac and Oldsmobile and Chevrolet, that kind of corporation was invented by Alfred P. Sloan, and he ran General Motors for about 25 years, from the 30s to the 50s, and made it the dominant company in American business. And Ray had a fortune and used that, decided he was going to use that fortune for the public good.
Yeah, and he was the guy who came up with the idea of a new model of car every year.
A new model of car every year and segmented divisions so that every division was aimed at a particular part of the consumer landscape at different price points, different luxury points. So he created constant desire for the products of the company.
Yeah, that's really brilliant because, I mean, he was not competing against himself then. They were sort of like these ladders or these gradients that you would go up based on your income and your success.
That's exactly right. And so you would always need a new and a different car.
Well, you have such an interesting portfolio of the things that you're involved with. I'm going to touch on just a few to give listeners a taste of the breadth and scope of it all. There has been significant grant making directed towards environmental issues, but not so much to the indoor environment. But Sloan has made a 10-year commitment to understanding the chemistry of built spaces. That's so interesting. Share with us what you're doing here and what you're finding out.
Yeah. So our chemistry of the indoor environment program actually follows a program in the molecular biology of the indoor environment. So if I start with that one, it starts with the observation that the bugs, the microbiome that's in this room is actually very different from what you would find out in the wild. Because we're here, because of the different ways, the surfaces that those bugs live on. And if we want to understand our health and the things that are going on here, we have to do a different kind of biology. So we built over 10 years a field of indoor microbiology, which is now a flourishing field. So coming out of that, we decided it was also important to understand the chemistry of what goes on inside rooms, inside houses. And again, if you want to think about why that's different from outdoor atmospheric chemistry, outdoors, the atmosphere is big, and it's mostly lots of air flowing around. In here, it's surfaces, right? The indoors, it's all surfaces, and it's all the chemicals that you and I bring in. So that's partly the stuff that comes out of our bodies, but it's a lot of it the stuff that we slather on our bodies. And so the kinds of chemical reactions, the kinds of chemicals that are important to the environment in which we're living are very different indoors, and there's required a whole different set of tools and adaptations of instruments to do that work indoors. And that's what we're supporting now. We've been doing it for a few years, and we're going to do it for about a decade. And we're hoping to build a whole field of indoor chemistry.
Fantastic. What I have always known Sloan the best for is the Sloan Research Fellowship Program. That is your signature science program. You were one yourself, as a matter of fact. And it's also an on-ramp for many future Nobel Prize winners. Tell us about it and share some of its rich history.
So this goes back all the way to the 50s, and Sloan felt strongly that to support science and economics, what you had to support young people, And that, and they were the future. And you had to support them in ways which gave them flexibility around what they were going to do. So for decades now, we've given about 100 of these Sloan Research Fellowships in a number of fields to people not long after their PhD, before they get tenure,
okay,
when they're still building their research programs. And we've had almost 50 of our former Sloan Research Fellows win Nobel Prizes. This year, one of the economics prizes, Nobel Prizes, went to a former Sloan Research Fellow, and one of the prizes in physics went to one. And she was actually only the third woman to win the Nobel Prize in physics. It was absolutely terrific.
What did she win it for?
She won it, along with her advisor, for inventing ways of making very fast laser pulses, which turned out to be really important if you're interested in studying the dynamics of things that are happening really fast. So it was an incredibly important tool. She did it about 30 years ago. So as a former Sloan Research Fellow, I can tell you that a little bit of money, and it's about, now that prize is about $70,000, that can make an enormous difference early in somebody's career as they're trying to build their career and get tenure. And the foundation's had a wonderful record of supporting the right people.
Yeah, along with the prestige of winning it. It's going to
Tenure packet when you say you've won a Sloan Research Fellowship.
I bet it does. You know, another major area of focus for the foundation is economics. And to this day, the foundation remains the largest single private funder of economic research. And I guess that's kind of built into your DNA, having been found in 1934 around the Depression. I mean, that was central in everybody's mind. A lot of this work is on behavioral economics and choice architecture and decision making by individuals and households. Tell us a little bit about that work.
Yeah. So the foundation's been supporting behavioral economics since the late 80s, really since the birth of the field. And it's an example of what we like to do when we're really being, when the thing that we like to do the most, which is to come into a new field in which techniques from one field may be entering another. In this case, techniques taken from psychology entering economics, where maybe people aren't supported yet because nobody quite knows what to make of that field. But we get in there early and support people. And so behavioral economics is now an enormous field.
Yeah.
It's very popular. A lot of people working on it. We still support it. But I think our greatest contribution was to be there at the beginning when nobody was supporting it. And I think that that's one of the things you can do as a foundation is you have a flexibility to make a bet on something that seems like a really great idea. I think the most impactful thing we've done in behavioral economics was when the Obama White House set up a unit to think about behavioral nudges to help people make good choices around federal programs. That was a Sloan-supported fellow who went into the Obama White House to set up that office. And they did a lot of really, really great work that really has made people's lives better.
Yeah. And it would also seem that the breadth of everything you do gives you wonderful peripheral vision in terms of working on something and being inspired to work on something in a completely different field, which a lot of single-focused foundations don't have that ability.
There's an enormous amount of crosstalk, as it were, between our programs. And maybe we'll talk a little bit about the digital technology program at some point. But let me mention something, which is another thing we support in economics is what we call administrative data research centers. And that sounds like a really boring, long word. But what it really means is there's all sorts of data that is collected by companies or by the government that is public data, but not organized in a way that people can make good use research use of it. So we've been funding centers which collect this data. And this is, again, public data, not private data, and organize it and make it available. That's an economics project, but it's also a digital technologies project. And so the people who work on digital technologies at the foundation are collaborating in this grant making with the people who support economics. And we do a lot of that collaboration across the foundation. And it's some of the most exciting stuff we do.
Well, I'm glad you don't have those silos. I'll tell you something that isn't boring to me is your Working Longer program for those who need to or want to work beyond the conventional retirement age. What are some of the things that I should know, Adam?
Well, one of the things you should know is one of the best economic choices you can make is to delay your retirement as long as possible. What we're particularly interested in that program is the effect on people of working longer. That is, this again came out of an earlier program on workplace flexibility that we supported for more than a decade, and trying to help companies and people understand the needs of modern workers and the ways in which the giving them more flexibility would make their lives better, but also make workplaces more productive. And so similarly with working longer, we're trying to understand what it's like for people what are the needs that people have if they're going to work longer, let's say well into their 60s, and also how can that benefit companies, take that expertise that people have and continue to benefit from it.
Mm-hmm.
So just raising the profile of that, doing research on what's happening, giving people the tools they need to make good policy, although not advocating for that policy ourselves, that's our niche there.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking a lot about science, technology, and economics, but you're also dedicated to the public understanding of those areas. And boy, this is a multifaceted program with film and radio and new media and TV. What have been some of your more successful ventures here?
So our theory of change, as it were, around public understanding is that as much as it's important to support really great documentaries, to help people really understand the importance of science, you have to go far beyond that. So I'm a scientist, and the weakness that we scientists have is that when we explain something and we don't think it's been understood, we think the solution would be to explain it some more.
Maybe a little louder.
A little louder with more diagrams. And of course, it's really silly. Often what people need is to understand science as something that is close to them, that's done by people that they can relate to, people that they might not have expected to be scientists and that they're going to trust. So very recently, for example, we've supported a documentary about Hedy Lamarr.
Mm.
So Hedy Lamarr, you can see that. I think it's on television.
She's a brilliant woman.
She was a brilliant woman, and she was the most beautiful movie star of her day, but she was an inventor.
Mm-hmm.
And she made significant contributions during the war to technology, something called frequency hopping, which is now essential to all cell phone technology.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think of an inventor, you don't think of Hedy Lamarr. But in fact, that she was, as a woman at a time when it was hard as a woman to be supported and recognized for the work you do, as a movie star when nobody expected that of her, she was incredibly important for the technologies we have today. So we want people to think about that. Hidden Figures is an incredible movie. We supported Margot Shetterly in finishing that book. And again, that's a book that's a story that's about how do you get to the moon and what math do you need? What's the science of getting to the moon? But it's also a different story about who got us there. So I think the best things that we do in our public understanding program are simultaneously teaching people facts about science and technology, but also broadening their sense of who does science and technology and making them comfortable with the communities of us scientists.
Right. Well, at your heart, you have to be a storyteller.
Yeah, it's a storyteller. It's all storytelling.
It sure is. Well, let's pick up on what you talked about before, digital information technology. And there's so many tremendous opportunities with the internet and computing technology. One of those areas that I thought was interesting was scholarly communications, which you're really enabling scientists to work together better and to share research. Tell us a little bit about that.
So this is part of a program where we want to invest in tools that make science better.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is the investing in ways in which scientists can share information broadly. So some of what we do is invest in software that scientists use to collaborate. And then one of the things we're really interested in is investing in other ways that they disseminate their what they have discovered. So to give you an example of that, a lot of the work that scientists do takes a long time to come out in journals. And they would like to distribute it earlier and via preprint servers and kind of online communications. And we've made grants to help scientists do that well. That leads to, for example, better collaboration, and it leads to better reproducibility of research if people can share and collaborate earlier, but also can share their work at an earlier stage. So these are tools that are hard to support outside the foundation world.
Right.
There aren't enough users that the commercial kind of world can really support that. Government funding agencies often don't want to support that. And so there's a niche for foundations can come in, and there's a great leverage in making the work of scientists better with just some relatively modest investments in these things.
You've also made some investments in the universal access to knowledge. What have some of those been?
Well, the one that we're the most excited about is for a long time, early on and for a long time, we've been a supporter of Wikipedia. And that is, I think, as good an example as one can find about a free resource that is supported by foundations and by individual gifts that has broadened the ability to know about all sorts of things for anyone in the world on their phone. It's an astonishing fact of the world that you can pick up your phone and through Wikipedia get very good information on almost anything. And the idea that Wikipedia is kind of schlocky and isn't to be trusted, that's entirely wrong, actually. Yeah. It's one of the most reliable sources of information that there is because it's crowdsourced mm-hmm. and because everyone's contributing to it. And doing that in a way that I have to say is civil and is respectful mm-hmm. and where facts matter.
Hard to believe if you had to make a bet 20 years ago, Wikipedia or Encyclopedia Britannica, which one would make it and which one would die? And I think a lot of us would have had that one wrong.
We would have had it wrong. And I think the thing that Wikipedia has going for it is its infinite expandability mm-hmm. and it and updatability. Yeah. You bought those we all had those encyclopedias on our shelves when we were kids, and they were frozen in time. And they give you a little book every year. You buy the update, but at the end of the day, they were really static. And the world is moving just too fast.
One last thing I want to ask you about digital, and this is your longest running science program, and that would be the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. What's that about?
So this is one that's a real favorite of mine. And we started supporting this collaboration in astronomy back in the 90s. Mm. So let me tell you a little bit about it. For the longest time, for centuries, what astronomy meant was taking a big piece of glass, a mirror, and a camera, and pointing it at the sky, object by object, and looking really hard at that galaxy or that nebula or that planet, and learning as much about it, and then moving on to the next one. What was realized in the early 1990s was that with the invention of computerized cameras, CCD cameras, which are now everywhere, mm-hmm. and the ability to store and analyze terabytes of data, you could do a totally different kind of astronomy. Hmm. And this is an astronomy where you survey the sky and you measure everything, but just a little bit about everything instead of a lot about a few things. Millions of galaxies in a single year were measured, the spectra, that is what the light looked like. And you can do a completely different kind of science with that. And it has transformed the way that people do astronomy. A lot of the cosmology, our understanding of the birth of the early universe and dark energy, that comes from these kinds of surveys. So that's been running for 20 years. Mm-hmm. So we've just renewed it for another 5.
Great.
There's a telescope is in New Mexico and one is in Chile. And I think it's very important that I go visit the one in Chile. And I should say it's also transformed the way people do astronomy because this is done in a big collaboration mm-hmm. and astronomers had to learn how to collaborate. And now this is how they do that. And finally, they release the data to the public.
Yeah.
So if you go on to SDSS, Sloan Digital Sky Survey's website.
Open source. It's
open source. You can find the data. 4 out of every 5 papers that are written with the data from the Sky Survey are written by people who are not part of that collaboration, but are people who went online and used the data themselves.
That's how we make progress.
So it's how we make progress, and I just love that project.
One last thing I want to ask you about your program, and that is your support of underrepresented minority students in something you call the MPhD program. Right. Tell us about that.
So I think there's a question that every institution that wants to make the world better, and certainly the Sloan Foundation is one, and colleges and universities, and has to be thoughtful about in this day and age. And that is, how are we going to participate in increasing the diversity and inclusion of those fields that we care about,
mm-hmm.
right? I think that is a fundamental question for our society. It's a fundamental question for every institution that works within our society. And so at the foundation, we take that very, very seriously as absolutely core to what we do. And it takes a number of forms. I mean, the first is the one that you mentioned, that our niche there is graduate education. And so we make grants to institutions, long-term grants that are designed not just to support individual students, but to change culture, to make graduate programs in science more diverse and mm-hmm. more inclusive, to think not just about who comes in the door, but how you support people of color and women in fields in which they are underrepresented. Because the future of science and engineering depends on this.
No question.
And the second thing that we do is every single grant that you get, I don't care what that grant is in, if you get a grant from the Sloan Foundation, you need to be thoughtful about and prove to us that you're being thoughtful about how that contributes to diversity and inclusion If you're holding a conference, we want to know, what does the speaker list look like? Mm-hmm. And who are you inviting? If you have a postdoctoral program, well, who have you had as your postdocs? Who are your graduate students? In our public understanding program, how are you telling the stories of scientists who aren't just white men?
Mm-hmm.
And I think by keeping that central focus as a piece of everything we do, we can change the conversation about these issues in science and engineering and mathematics and economics, and we're deeply committed to that.
Yeah, and that's one of the great things foundations can do, because they're in a position to have that kind of leverage, and that's how we change the field, and that's how we change our thinking. You know, you're a mission-driven organization, and listeners have just heard the breadth and scope of what you do is breathtaking. Is there ever any danger, Adam, of mission drift? And if there is, what do you do to assure that that doesn't occur? Yeah.
Well, that's a great question, because Alfred P. Sloan isn't around anymore.
No.
You know, and I think he's left us this extraordinary endowment, which is almost $2 billion and allows us to make grants of $80 million every year.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to balance two things. We have to balance fidelity to the vision that he had with the reality that it's 80 years after he founded the foundation. And that, there's no magic bullet to that. We have the letters he wrote when he was the president of the foundation. And we go back and we look at them.
Good
and
for you.
When we think about our mission statement, when we think about what we're doing, we are very aware of Mr. Sloan
mm-hmm.
and what he thought he was doing when he was establishing the foundation. So, but we broaden it. Let me give you an example of that. When he was very interested right in the beginning in particularly in economics and the public understanding of economics. His particular interest in economics was a worry that there would be too much government intervention in the economy. He was socially relatively progressive for his time, but
mm-hmm.
economically quite conservative. And he wasn't at all happy about the ways in which during the Depression, the government had, and then the war, the government had become much more involved in the economy. So what he had in mind was to educate people about the importance of free markets and the problems with socialism. And in fact, the public understanding of economics program was quite polemical.
Mm-hmm.
And they produced comic books that explained free enterprise, but with a particular purpose
yeah.
in mind. So we still believe deeply in a public understanding program, but it's not about that
mm-hmm.
anymore. And the reason we think that's consistent is that in a deeper sense, what he wanted was an educated public.
Yeah.
He felt that people had to understand the world around them in a rational, evidence-based way in order to make good decisions. So what that sentence may mean now may be different than what it meant in the late 40s, but that's a value that I think keeps us from drifting far from what Alfred P. Sloan would have wanted. So I think if he came back, he hangs in a portrait in our lobby, and if that portrait were to come to life and look around and look at our grant making, I feel really confident that he would say, I would never thought we'd be funding any of that. But boy, that seems like exactly the right stuff to be funding in 2018.
Yeah, you didn't take it literally. You took his intent.
That's right.
And you applied it to the modern day. And that evolution, I must say, sounds a lot like Pew.
Yeah.
The Pew Charitable Trust had the same thing about the free markets and things. And they evolved over time. Mm-hmm. But have also remained true, I think, to the founder's vision.
I think one thing that we hold to very tightly is a niche that's, I think, a very what we call our Sloaney niche, which is we fund research. And whatever we may think personally and privately about the issues of the day, we do not do policy advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
We want to remain a trusted party by everyone in the policy debates. And so we keep our personal policy preferences out of it.
Yeah.
And we fund research and let it go wherever the facts may
take
us.
Follow the facts, follow the truth.
And so we have a program in energy in the environment, which is actually one of the very few programs funded by foundations that stays away from advocacy. And it's not that we don't think that these environmental and energy issues aren't important, but it's because we think that somebody needs to just fund the research
mm-hmm.
and that everyone can then rely on as they argue about policy. And so we try to hew very closely to that value in the grant making that we do.
The foundation is dealing at the very highest levels in the fields of science, technology, engineering, math, economics. And the U.S. has held a preeminent position in those fields for quite a few decades now. With the advances by other nations around the world, the Chinas, the Indias, the others, how do you believe we're stacking up today?
I mean, I don't think there's any question that at this moment, the United States is still the engine of innovation around the world. I think we are in that position because we, over the decades, have attracted people from the brightest people from all over the world. It's like we've hoovered them up out of all the corners of the globe and brought them here and kept them here. And if you look at the great companies in this country, many of them were founded by immigrants. The most important thing we can do to retain our preeminence in leadership around innovation is to continue to support the immigration of bright young people from around the world. And that includes just young people who are students, not just people who are already professionals. We need to make this an attractive country to come to. And if we are an attractive country to come to where people feel welcome to immigrate, the brightest people in the world will come here and we will continue to lead the world. And the greatest threat is that we stop doing that. Mm-hmm. And if we stop doing that, we're not going to be leaders anymore. I'm certain of that.
Adam, you were the president of Williams College, a marvelous institution, for the 8 years or so before you took on this position. How has that transition been? I'm sure some of it's been great. Some of it's been difficult. Tell us about it.
Well, it's been a wonderful transition, and I loved being the president of Williams. And before that, I was the dean of arts and sciences at Johns Hopkins, and I loved that. I think that this is a different way of using a resource to make change and to make the world better. And in many ways, I support many of the same people. I support many of the same faculty as the president of the Sloan Foundation that I did when I was the dean at Johns Hopkins, the same researchers doing many of the same things, but from a different place. So I'm learning the ways in which foundations can operate differently than the deans and presidents, much more flexibility, much more kind of discretion to make decisions. And with that comes much more responsibility to be really careful about the decisions one makes. I will tell you that I miss being around students. Yeah. I've been in higher education my entire life, my entire professional life. And before that, as a student, I was in higher education. And there's an energy that students bring. And even at their most complex, and even when they're saying things that make the president unhappy, there's a wonderful energy. They are the future. And so one of the things that I love doing is we can still support graduate students as part of the work we do at Sloan Foundation. But I miss being around those kids.
Yeah, yeah. I can see you have a few gray hairs from that.
I was 6'4" and had a full head of hair when I started that job.
You know, some of the keenest observations about a field can come from those who are not steeped in it. And as I mentioned, your background is primarily academia, Williams and Johns Hopkins and some other places. So although you were tangentially connected to the foundation world, you were not part of it. But now you are. You're in this space, albeit for less than a year. What have you noticed? Has anything delighted you? Has anything been cause for concern?
I think one of the things that's the most exciting about this world, and I've met colleagues who are in foundations across the country, lead these institutions, both in New York and some of the big foundations here, but also out west. Many of the exciting science foundations are out west. And one of the things that's the most exciting as I talk to these colleagues is the way in which we have a kind of flexibility to respond to needs that we perceive with more nimbleness than any other institutions that have the resources to help. And that's really exciting. And one of the things about academia is that it's very conservative and it moves slowly. And that's actually good because those are institutions that last for hundreds of years and with many constituencies. But when we see a need, we can act on it. Mm-hmm. And that gives us a responsibility and an opportunity. And so if I think about us at the foundation, we've recently invested in a project with a bunch of other foundations to make Facebook data available for researchers in a really responsible way that respects privacy, but that also helps us understand what's going on with our democracy. And we and a number of foundations pulled this together along with the Social Science Research Council in a period of a couple of months.
That's exciting.
That never could have happened in any other sector. Mm-hmm. And it's the ability to do that kind of work, that kind of speed and that kind of flexibility that I think is really exciting and gives us an enormous opportunity and responsibility.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would like to see the foundation sector be a little bit more bold in all that, right. But they can act really quickly when they put their minds to it.
I think that's right. And we can take risks.
Mm-hmm.
And we do take risks, and which means that some of the things that we fund don't work.
Yeah, right?
That's
right.
What you can't only take the risks on the things that are going to work. And we are free to take some risks.
Yeah, we need them. Describe the corporate culture of Sloan, how things get done, how people interact, what those unwritten rules are, and anything special or notable that you've observed since you've been there.
Well, so the Sloan Foundation is a wonderful place to work from the inside. It's one of the reasons that I came there. It's very academic, actually. Hmm. We have all these programs we talk through, and they're really led by program directors. We have 7 program directors, each of whom makes grants in their programs, shows leadership in those programs, is responsible for them, is deeply embedded in the communities of scholars and practitioners who are there funding. And then we as a group share the responsibility for all that grant making. Every grant that's made is talked through by all of the program directors together and me. So it's a very academic and kind of scholarly environment. Those 7 program directors are 6 PhDs and 1 Rhodes Scholar.
Mm.
So they're interested in ideas. We're interested in ideas. And so the work is very collaborative, very congenial. And it builds that sense of responsibility for, as you were mentioning before, that fidelity to the original vision of Alfred P. Sloan. We hold that together.
Mm-hmm.
And we really enjoy as much the engagement with each other's work as with our own.
Yeah, it sounds pretty silo-free.
It's really silo-free, and that's what allows some of that cross-pollination across the programs that we talked about.
Let me close with this, Adam. While remaining true to the traditions of the foundation, do you have a vision for where you would like to take Sloan, initiatives you can promote and champion that will advance the institution and make it even more relevant than it already is? Yeah.
I mean, I think that the foundation is constantly evolving in the programs that we're supporting. And as I look forward, I'm particularly interested in deepening our commitments around diversity and inclusion and within the PhD programs, but also within academic cultures. And we're doing some exciting grant making there. I'm really interested in our science programs. We tend to support science programs for about a decade, and we have a couple of them that are ending.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is molecular biology of the built environment. And we also have an earth science program called the Deep Carbon Observatory.
Deep Carbon, right, yeah.
So we have an opportunity to do some new program building in science. And I'm really excited about that. The challenge is to find an area where the scale of resources that we can invest can have a real impact. And we stay away, for example, from medical research because we are dropping the bucket.
Right.
But there are always emerging areas where a Sloan program can pull something forward, can invest maybe in the interstitial areas between two fields where the most exciting work is going on. So we're looking to figure out what that's going to be over the next couple of years, and I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, still slightly orphaned, but very, very ripe.
That's exactly right.
Well, Adam Falk, the president of the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Lots and lots of information on that website of yours. What is a website, and what will visitors find there?
So if you go to www.sloan.org, you'll find information about all of our programs and links to the grantees themselves if you want to know even more than that. So I welcome you to come there.
And you can sign up for a quarterly newsletter too, right?
You can sign up to hear and get news from the foundation, absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, Adam. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
It's been great. Thank you so much.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.